Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your top O the Week podcast from the magazine that brings you free minds and free markets. I'm Matt Welch, joined per usual by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Howdy, comrades.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Right back at ya.
Happy Monday.
We are going to get to the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, if it's still ongoing by the time we hit publish on this thing, here in a moment. But first, do you find yourself fatigued trying to keep up with the news, stymied by paywalls, lured in by empty calorie clickbait? Well, imagine an app where you can get unlocked access to the most reliable news sites, an app that filters out fake news and trashy listicles while showing stories from multiple perspectives in order to counter bias, where you can find actually good news, as in, like, positive developments, in addition to various unearthed nuggets from around the world. All of this and more is available from an innovative Australian startup called Inkl, I-N-K-L. Inkl.com has signed partnerships with more than 100 news sources, such as The Economist, The Atlantic, and Bloomberg. Basically everywhere Meghan McCardle's ever worked. Sorry, that was an ad lib. Creating a unique system combining journalists and algorithms to create a best of news feed. You can get more than $12,000 worth of premium news for just $100 a year. And if you go right now to Inkl.com/podcast, they'll give you an additional 25% discount. So that's a whole year's worth of headache-free news for just $75. Go to Inkl.com/podcast today. You'll be glad you did. All right, closing arguments are expected to begin, possibly end today, Monday, as we're speaking, in the murder trial of 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who in August of 2020, when he was 17, on the third night of rioting in Kenosha, Wisconsin, following the police shooting of a black man named Jake Blake, traveled there from his nearby hometown carrying an AR-15, got involved in a violent fracas, and ended up shooting three men, killing two of them. There's been some unusual aspects to the proceedings so far, including Rittenhouse testifying in his own behalf, which doesn't always happen in a murder trial, taking the stand, and also the judge there, Bruce Schroeder, controversial judge, has been reprimanding the prosecuting assistant DA, Thomas Binger, for stepping over various lines, including perhaps even constitutional lines. Meanwhile, the trial has kind of reignited a lot of the polarizing debate that we saw in 2020 in the summer after the George Floyd killing in Minnesota and all the sort of demonstrations and sporadic violence and rioting that came afterwards. Rittenhouse has been portrayed as a racist vigilante on one hand and kind of a hero trying to restore order in a place where people, the authorities had withdrawn from trying to maintain order. There are something like 500 National Guards people on alert in case there is rioting after the verdict comes out. So, Catherine, as we have stressed in our internal communications, we are not going to relitigate the litigation in this particular case. And I know all of us have been busy doing other things. Nick was washing his cat, for example, over the last 5 days. So we didn't watch every single little bit of the trial. However, we've published a bunch at Reason, and enough of the ambient coverage and discussion has trickled through. Looking at the trial itself, reaction to it, and just sort of what it was about in 2020 and the various debates with it. What does it all mean, Catherine? What's a broad kind of way that you're looking at this, and what does it tell you about where America's at?
So one of my big takeaways is that people don't care about an issue until they perceive that their guy is being treated unfairly. And so my big takeaway from this is that if we get a new cluster of people who are suddenly interested in prosecutorial abuse and criminal justice reform more generally, from the perspective of Rittenhouse kind of really being treated badly, then welcome. Welcome to the party. That's my kind of cheerful gloss on this. The prosecutor in this case does seem to be not covering himself in glory, let's say. He's not perhaps the finest specimen of his type. And like, some of my best friends are prosecutors, right? Like, I don't mean to say that there is no such thing as a good prosecutor, but a lot of the system is rigged to permit, enable, protect bad prosecutors. And we are really seeing that. And people are paying attention. A different group of people are paying attention right now than have been paying attention for the last couple of years. And I hope that that interest and that kind of indignation is sustained in a useful way.
Nick, there's been a lot of discussion, criticism from the right, saying that the left broadly, Democrats in power, the media kind of egged on, encouraged, or looked the other way with the violent aspects of the demonstrations and riots that took place last summer, and that that chaos is to blame, at least partly, if for this particular thing, but just also for a lot of negative things that happened in a lot of potentially violent situations. Do you think that's a fair critique?
I think it's partly correct in the sense that, you know, there was violence going on. I mean, there was looting and burning and things like that. But I think taking it back to the first point of contact, you know, after the Jacob Blake incident, which also, you know, is confusing. The George Floyd, you know, something like George Floyd and Breonna Taylor are rare, if only in their the moral clarity that those incidents really force on a conversation. There is just no justification for the way that George Floyd was killed or Breonna Taylor was killed. And I think conservatives and kind of, you know, law and order people are slow to acknowledge that because they think if they admit cops anywhere ever do anything wrong or law enforcement, then, you know, mere anarchy ensues. And that's
Although,
just wrong.
Just to interject, I think that George Floyd, and we've talked about this previously, the George Floyd case was kind of a rare exception to that. There was a, almost universally, at least at
Absolutely.
First.
Absolutely. Yeah, he was denounced. The police and the police union didn't even try to back these guys. So that's extremely rare. But I'm saying those incidents are few and far between. And you still hear among right wingers, you know, it's, oh, George Floyd had, a ton of fentanyl in him. He was a large black man with drugs in his system. Ergo, he was a threat who could, you know, single-handedly, like, jump over buildings and things like that. And I think, you know, the Jacob Blake case is also one where, you know, Jacob Blake, you know, precipitated this action. However, what I'm getting at is the city of Kenosha created the context for an absolute chaos to reign. You were mentioning there's 500 National Guardsmen on duty now, you know, as this, when the verdict is read, they called in 100 National Guardsmen during the looting and rioting and stuff like that. So it's like, you know, in the same way that a lot of stuff in D.C. and in a lot of cities, and we saw this, you know, most spectacularly, Matt, you and I will recall the L.A. riots when the verdict in the Rodney King trial, or rather the people who beat Rodney King, was coming out. The LAPD was nowhere to be found in a meaningful way. And that's, you know, that's a breakdown of government at its most basic functioning, which is to maintain public order. And I think we have to go back to that in Kenosha quite a bit. And the reason why I'm stressing this is because on another level, what Kenosha looks like, Nellie Bowles, the New York Times reporter, who is married to Barry Weiss, and I'm on Barry Weiss's Substack, Common Sense, talked about this incident, you know, as showing what happens when the police are actually defunded, defanged, and are completely incompetent in maintaining social order, and you get something like this. And I also just want to point out, maybe we can come back to it, the other trial that's going on here that I think is actually more important in many significant ways, maybe not in culture war ways, but about what's actually going on in America, is the Ahmaud Arbery trial of the three people who are charged with killing him.
Do you want to give a brief gloss on that, Nick?
Well, I mean, he's the black, black man who was shot in Georgia, in May of last year, where a bunch of guys got in a truck. They saw him jogging through the neighborhood and they thought that he was trying to break into houses, and they forced a confrontation, which ended with, Arbery being killed. And they're on trial now. And that's a trial that seems to be going. It's a more clear-cut situation, and it looks bad for the defendants because they were doing something that they shouldn't have been doing.
One thing that connects those things, sorry to step on your line, but I'm going to, is, and you see this in the framing of the news coverage that tie those together and sometimes also get into the case from Florida, where Peter Suderman is from, of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, the Stand Your Ground case. But the thing that ties them all together in the framing is vigilantism, and that America has a particularly weird, strong, over Batmaned vigilantism, where people who have more access to guns than in most other countries take it upon themselves to enforce the law, and they end up shooting and killing people, and maybe they shouldn't do that. So Suderman, I'll pose this as a question. Is it a good idea to bring an AR-15 to a riot when you're 17 years old?
Well, I think that in this very specific case, it's pretty hard to defend the notion that Kyle Rittenhouse should have taken a gun to what he expected to be a conflict zone. And that, I think it's, I won't say that no one has defended it, but I don't find the defenses very convincing. And I think it's pretty clear. I would say that it's pretty clear to me that Kyle Rittenhouse should not have been there, and that it was a deep error of judgment to take up arms and to go to the scene as he did. Now, just because it was a deep error of judgment does not mean that he is guilty of a crime or that he is guilty in specific of murder. And the question of whether he is guilty of murder is a question of whether he acted in a way that is clearly unreasonable at the time. And what we know is that he had a crowd of people chasing him, that he was retreating from that crowd, and that in at least one instance, a firearm was raised and pointed at him, and that he responded with the firearm that he had with him. And so, you know, I think it's useful to separate the questions of whether or not it was a good idea for Kyle Rittenhouse to be there and to have gone to some place where he thought, where he presumed there would be rioting, and where he presumed there would be some forms of at least property violence and conflict, from the question of whether or not he is guilty. And far too much of the commentary around this case has decided to conflate those questions and say that because he made an error of judgment going there, and I do think it is an error of judgment and a serious one, but that because he made the error of judgment in going there, he is therefore guilty of murder. And that's not how the legal system does work. It's not how it should work. And it's not even how public criticism of these events should work. And people who are supposed to be, you know, professional political commentators should know better.
Can I ask, though, just to complicate this, because I am of two minds on this, because, you know, on the one hand, the idea of somebody like Kyle Rittenhouse walking down streets carrying an AR-15 kind of creeps me out, to be quite honest. Like, if, you know, when I go outside, I remember the first time I went to Europe in the 80s, and I was in France, and there had been a bunch of terrorist scares. So there were cops and army people with machine guns on every street corner. And I remember going into a bathroom and there was a guy next to me with a fucking machine gun on his back taking a piss. And I'm like, I really don't want to be around this. You know, this is like creepy. I don't
clear,
like having...
Just so I understand what you're describing here and so our readers or listeners understand, you're describing agents of the state, police officers, military people.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, when you...
Which is different than Kyle Rittenhouse, right?
When you're walking down the street, you know, and there are people walking around with guns, long guns slung over their shoulders, that freaks me out, to be quite honest. In this kind of instance, and part of the backdrop of this is there were a bunch of guys who were in militias who were defending property that was, you know, in risk of being burned down and things like that. And they all disowned Kyle Rittenhouse. They said he wasn't with them. And I guess that's the case. But on a certain level, there's a difference between vigilantism and kind of property defense that could be properly done. And in certain circumstances, especially when the state has completely, you know, kind of punted on doing anything, you know, private citizens do this. The Koreans in in LA during the Rodney King riots, you know, they were folk heroes, and they still are, even among blacks sometimes, you know, because they defended their property, they defended their community. No, but I'm just saying it gets really complicated. And for me, the real question that is worth struggling with is, from a libertarian perspective or from a left-wing defund the police thing, what do you do if you say, okay, you know what, like, we're not going to have this, we're not going to have a state monopoly on violence, or we're not going to have police that actually do much, You know, is this what you look forward to?
Yeah, I would say I genuinely have kind of the opposite instinct of yours, Nick, which is that, or I guess I share the momentary impulse of like a bunch of uniformed guys with guns walking around does make me nervous, but precisely because they're agents of the state, I actually, you know, I'm an Acela corridor monster, right? Like I'm the fucking worst. So like you have to contextualize my comments here, but I like to see people walking around armed. I assume that the people, especially people who I can see that they are carrying, that they are actually far more likely to have done their homework, to be rule abiding, especially in areas where guns are more heavily regulated. And I think that there's something, you know, I am generally not one for the martial virtues. I love me the capitalist virtues. I like prudence. I like temperance. I am not too big on valor, but
a nation of shopkeepers is better than a nation of
living in a nation of shopkeepers, not a nation of warriors. And yet I feel that there's something kind of very right about people protecting their own property. And when those threats are violent, to protect it with firearms strikes me as an appropriate response. I think the interesting question is what to do with the fact that Rittenhouse traveled to be there. Because I also am not one for like loyalty patriotism. Like I again prefer kind of like affiliational virtues. So maybe this impulse isn't sort of consistent with that, but I find it to be a different prospect for someone to be defending their own.
He had a job, property. He had connections to that community.
And again,
I mean, and what we're
so that's I'm just saying it's gray, right? He did not come out of his own home or his own business, which was under attack, and defend it. It's a little different. And I think some of those subtleties are the place where people's instincts about whether this is defensive fall down or struggle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I expect that he will be found not guilty. The gun charge has been thrown out, the illegal ownership, from what I understand. And as the self-defense case seems like it's going to stick. But then you go to the, you know, Brunswick, Georgia with Arbery, where it's guys in their neighborhood literally getting in a pickup truck with guns and hunting down a black guy because they said, you know, and trying to do a citizen's arrest because they thought he was roaming around in a construction site. So those are people who are defending their neighborhood, and they seem to be acting out of incredibly terrible motives in an incompetent way. Because if you've got guns and you're making a citizen's arrest and you can't do that without killing the guy, I don't know, you're probably not that good at
and it seems that
playing policeman.
Rittenhouse was pretty incompetent too, right? Like with neither of those examples are someone who's like at the top of their game. And also neither of those examples are people who were like operating on really strong empirical assumptions either, right? Like you can say, okay, you know, did this come from, you know, dispositionally, where did this come from? Was it racism? Whatever. But you also have to say, like, just how good was their information? And, you know, in the Arbery case, like their information was just absolute garbage. Again, with Rittenhouse, it's a little harder. Like there really were threats to property. Things really were pretty bad. Was he the right person to beat those back? Pretty clearly not.
Peter, you follow the comes and goings of Washington, Capitol Hill, probably most of the four of us, including the big pieces of the Biden's domestic agenda, one of which may be stalled. We might talk about that later. But it's striking to me how much of the conversation in the country in the summer of 2020 was about criminal justice reform, how much the Democratic primary campaign was discussing criminal justice reform, and how utterly absent it has been from the conversation about Biden's domestic agenda this year. Am I missing something? Is my ear not operating on the right frequency? Or did just nothing happen and they're just not going to make any kind of federal case about criminal justice reform?
I can't speak to whether or not you have perfect policy pitch or not.
Yes.
But I think that's right. I mean, it has been basically absent because the Biden administration came in and they were focused on the pandemic and the economy and on relating those two things, and then using the economic disruptions that were caused by both the pandemic and pandemic policy that had already happened under Trump. They were focused on using those as pretexts to do all the spending that Democrats had already wanted to do. And that meant that criminal justice issues sort of fell by the wayside.
Catherine, you referenced earlier, you know, welcome new people who are just noticing bad things about the criminal justice system. If there are any takeaways from this particular trial or even this discussion thereof that could apply towards reforms that need to happen, can you think of some offhand in case you were being a helpful, friendly libertarian, encouraging people to do the reforms to make things better?
Prosecutorial immunity isn't great. We should probably have less of that thing. The protection that this prosecutor and all prosecutors receive, even when they're conducting themselves in a manner that crosses them into a space where they should probably be civilly liable, that is something we could roll back, maybe should roll back. The other takeaway I would say is there was a little back and forth earlier in the trial in which the prosecutor attempted to suggest that Rittenhouse's silence after his arrest was evidence of his guilt. And the judge was scathing, and rightly so, and said something like, "I was astonished that when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence, that's basic law. That's been basic law in this country. I don't know what you're up to." Like, yes. And I just think always everyone everywhere, even the most hardcore libertarian, can stand to be reminded, if you are arrested, what should you do, Peter?
Don't talk to the cops.
Shut the fuck up. Incredible advice. So maybe if America can just hear that, that's a real news you can use kind of takeaway.
Very good. Okay. Changing topics here. It's really about me. I spent the last week or so driving around Southern California, looking around at stuff. And there are two things that they have so many of that they didn't have 13 years ago when I last lived there or whatever
and
it was.
And you're not going to say Mexicans, are you, Matt?
I am not.
They had Mexicans 13 years ago.
They always had.
Okay. Always not had as many Mexicans as they used to. Relatively speaking, the rate of increase has declined.
Okay. At any rate, of increase or decrease, is two things. One was tents for homeless dudes on every possible sidewalk, and basically every block, but also on every block, multiple signs saying help wanted. It was I've never seen anything like it in my life. I saw 1,000 help wanted signs driving around. I was driving around with my dad. He was just like, the point, you know how dads just like read things? Mickey D's when you're driving by.
Wow. That's a true
one of
observation.
The pure pleasures of getting older.
Ooh. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it, man.
Dads
I can't
do be
to
like
you.
That, though.
He was like, help on it. Help on it. Seeking job. The radio is just filled with like, hey, can you walk? Come down to the office, and if you don't urinate on yourself, here's a check. It's astonishing, and yet people are quitting all of their jobs in super huge droves, millions and millions of people just absolutely not working. Everybody needs help. So, Peter, I know that you are a computer doing a simulation of a human being. Can you spit out an answer for why? No, because we're done with the federal benefits, right? That incentive explanation doesn't work in the same way. What the hell's going on?
So there's no single root cause, but I think the shortest way to put it is that the pandemic and pandemic policy decisions radically upended the U.S. economy and in particular the labor market. And not only is it going to take some time to put itself back together, it's going to be put back together in a different form. And we're still figuring out what that form is going to look like. So I think we can point to a handful of sort of related, like a constellation of reasons, some more important than others, for why this is still happening. And so perhaps the biggest one is that workers have cash reserves thanks to a combination of personal savings and pandemic relief funds. So people got a lot of money because of policy decisions. And then also people saved a lot of money because they didn't do stuff for a whole year. And so that means that people have choices that they didn't have when they had less money, and in particular, the choice not to work because their bank accounts are padded here. So in addition to that, people spend a lot of time at home and away from work. And while it's a bit hard to, I think, prove this definitively, there's some really good reason to suspect that this just reoriented some people's values and expectations about time and about how they're going to spend their days. Right? I mean, when you put people in in a radically different circumstance for weeks or months or even over a year at a time. And you put millions and millions and millions of people in like a completely different work-life environment, you would just expect that at the margins, some people are going to come out of that thinking, hey, you know what? Now I feel differently about how I'm going to spend my time and about how much I want to work and how I want to work and where and when. And then you, in addition to that, and sort of related, you have people who went to work and worked throughout the pandemic, but feel deeply burnt out. We've talked about this a little bit before on this podcast. There's a phenomenon that people have dubbed the Great Resignation. You see this most prominently in the healthcare industry, at hospitals especially, where workers went through a very, very, very rough year. And every single person I know who works in the hospital industrial complex in the United States talks about how their labor market and their labor force is just absolutely crazy right now. They cannot, for any amount of money, fill the amount of jobs that they need to fill. And then a final thing that I think may be interesting to the youngs and the olds here, and also given some of Reason's history of flexible labor, is that there is a generational mismatch right now on work, and specifically work issues related to time flexibility. Whether you're going to be in the office, or whether you're going to work remotely, whether you're going to have to work a strict 9-to-5 and always be clocked in, or whether you're just kind of going to get your work done when you can get it done and build your life around that. And again, this is hard to prove, you know, with really solid polling data or an RCT or something, but there's been a bunch of reporting to suggest that younger workers who grew up with remote productivity technology and always on connection are really resisting demands to be in the office and to work straightforward 9-to-5 schedules. And their older bosses who grew up in that environment want them to. And so right now there's just a complication between what people who are hiring want and what people who might be hired are willing to do. And I think we're just seeing that across a whole bunch of different dimensions. And the fact that it's all happening at the same time in the aftermath of the biggest disruption to the labor market, certainly in my lifetime, but maybe ever in America's history, it's all happening at once. And it's not a single factor. And that's why the labor market is screwy. And why when I went home to Florida, the Wendy's not too far from my high school that I used to sneak out because we weren't allowed to go off campus to eat lunch. I used to sneak out to this Wendy's. And that Wendy's has a big sign out front that says, now hiring $500 signing bonuses. That was like more than you could make in a week at Wendy's at minimum wage when I was in high school.
And I guess those the young people aren't going to that. You know, they want to do that work remotely, right?
I mean, they got to operate. They got to do the telefry system.
The burger flipping robot.
Yeah, they're going to operate the robot from their computers from the metaverse, right?
I agree with most of what Peter is talking about, and would add a couple of things. One is we also have massively fewer immigrants than we had who were filling a lot of jobs that are, and particularly when you see a sign in the window saying we're hiring, it tends to be a service economy job, which can't be done remotely, which can't be done whenever you decide to show up. Immigrants were among the people who filled those jobs. There is a mismatch in the way jobs get filled now, particularly lower level jobs. Everything is done online, but I've talked to literally dozens of younger people who say, who are in college or out of high school and trying to find work, and they apply to, everything from Arby's to Zabar's online, and they just never hear back. So there's stuff like that. And then the other thing, though, the alpha and the zeta, actually. I say this as somebody who's the oldest person on this podcast.
On this planet.
A couple of months, yeah. And somebody who has spent a lot of time saying, millennials and Gen Z are great. They are better than previous generations. But I also want to point out, young people are really fucked up. And there was a recent poll that came out, and this adds to the labor shortage issue, a poll done by the Center for American Progress. And it asked people, boomers down to Gen Z, whether or not your physical health kept you from doing your usual activities. This was in January 2020. 71% of Gen Z and 61% of millennials said that their poor physical health kept them from doing their usual activities at least sometime The number for boomers was 38. People, younger people are not working through their pain, literally and figuratively. And when you look at the labor force participation rates, and I checked this out, we've seen, you know, between, I'm looking at U.S. labor statistics. In 2000, the total labor force participation rate for people 16 and older was 67%. It's now 61%. And when you look at like the people between 25 and 34, it went down by 4 points. If you look at people 55 and older, it went up by 7 points. The older people are working more than the younger people. And that is a huge shift. It has, there's a mental health component. There's something going on. What are you smirking at, Catherine?
I think I'm going to need a mental health break here before we go to the next segment.
Like it's a podcast.
Can I get a nap and a yoga session?
They can't smirk.
No, but I mean, we know this. We're going to say like, you know, it's this or it's that. But it's like younger people who are wealthier, they come from wealthier households than ever before, are opting not to work. And that's a huge part of this conundrum. And it may not be a value judgment in the end. It's an empirical reality, but that's what's fueling this. Older people are working more than ever. People over 55 are working more than they were 20 years ago. People under 35 are working less.
Certainly, to my mind, the easiest way to square that circle is where you started, Nick, which is with immigration, right? Like, fine, rich young people need to lay a bed to recover from their real or imagined ailments. Cool. Y'all do that. Let us know how it goes. In the meantime, though, it would be great if we could just let in like a massive number of people to do those jobs. That would be the best solution.
I mean, the first thing to fix it is just, you know, for the government. And this started, you know, in September, the federal extended benefits or enhanced benefits ended. And then most states have also killed it, although some still have it. But if the government pays people less not to work, I predict you'll see more people working.
We're going to go to our email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, similar problems? Must be a Gen Z or millennial. You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Kamala Harris needs with public relations, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month, with other financial aid also available, even though BetterHelp.com is affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/Roundtable, describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery, and they'll get you someone to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like the first person, get a second. Or even a third. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, please send your great and winningly brief emails, or at least readably brief emails, or questions via email at roundtable@reason.com. Also, start paying attention now, please. Thanks. You can begin sending us questions for our annual cool webathon videotape special bonus episode of the Roundtable that's coming up the first week of December. Send those to same email address. Just say, hey, this is a webathon question. And those might be, depending on Catherine's mood, which at the beginning of this podcast seemed to be, she wanted just to know what kind of comic book character she was, or I even forget because it's time has passed. We can be a bit
werewolves
more cheeky there.
Werewolves versus vampires, Matt. That was the important
werewolves
question.
Werewolves, vampires, that was the question. But also deep philosophical questions, and please put Nick on the spot about anything and everything. Although, actually, I think people want to put Suderman on the spot, including maybe in this question. No, not in this one. This one comes from Charlie from Seattle, who says a bunch of nice things that I'm not going to repeat, but just they're implied. He asks in the meaty part of the question, over the past few years, I've become more persuaded that Bitcoin represents a major increase in the potential for human freedom by giving anyone with an internet connection access to sound money. My question is this: why don't you talk more about this? More often than not, when anyone on the podcast refers to a libertarian moment, it sounds like it's with a this ain't never going to happen eye roll. That's Catherine. But what if Bitcoin is the libertarian moment? I don't mean to suggest that you should pivot to a crypto podcast. although kind of a good idea, or that BTC is obviously going to the moon, the whole thing may crash and burn, but it surprises me. The very possibility of leaving fiat money behind doesn't garner more attention from y'all. Are you wary of contributing to hype? Is there anything analogous to Bitcoin that in the past promised so much but failed to deliver? Do any of you own any cryptocurrencies? Charlie from Seattle. Catherine, let's start with your ownership of Ethereum.
I like that you couldn't even say that word. You're like
spitting it out with disgust.
Catherine owns Dogecoin. Let's be clear.
I own a smidgy bit of crypto. I'm not anything like an expert in the area, nor am I a major investor, but I think it's fun and interesting. No, this question, I actually have been talking about this a lot with people recently. I think this is kind of in the air. So it's a good question, Charlie, and a good question selection, Matt. I think that it's very possible that crypto is or will be as revolutionary as the internet was and is. But also, I am the eye roll that you hear is that I just have incredible, incredible faith in the governments of the world to screw this up. I think that even, you know, your question, you said, when have things like this gone wrong? Things exactly like this have gone wrong. Brian Doherty wrote an incredible piece about e-gold recently in the print magazine, which I commend to you. It tells the story of someone who really figured out a lot of this stuff, proto Bitcoin, basically, and just got completely screwed. And also PayPal is the story of this going wrong. There's a book called The PayPal Wars, which is really one of the most interesting books, I think, to grapple with this question of what happens when you have a utopian dream and a ton of, you know, intellectual, financial, technological firepower behind it, and governments just screw it up. Now, there were obviously some internal politics at PayPal, some other things going on there, but I just, you know, I know that if not Bitcoin, then Ethereum or other crypto, people say the whole beauty of it is it's not throttleable, it's decentralized, and that's true. But the state has its tentacles in every part of our lives, and you really cannot underestimate the ability of the government to screw up world-changing liberatory technologies. So I think when you hear the eye roll, that's what you're hearing. I would also say, though, we don't talk about it a ton on this podcast because I think none of us here are crypto bros. Like, we just don't happen to be. But we do have many of those people at Reason and in our world. And we have particularly some really, really great videos at Reason's YouTube channel, which is overseen by Jim Epstein. And he produced and overseen the production of a bunch of videos that really do touch on this liberatory potential. And then I know this answer is long, but I do want to say one more thing, which is that I think I struggle with either crypto is interesting because it is going to totally blow up the way we do money, or maybe it's interesting because it's actually just going to make our lives a little bit better. And the thing about the internet is it was both, right? It changed how we work and live and play and find romantic partners and find jobs, but it also just kind of made it like easier to buy dog food. And I think whether
with your Dogecoin,
you can buy dog food with dog money. And I think like the question of whether crypto in general, Bitcoin in particular, is going to be one or the other or both is divisive, and that it's easy to sound both utopian and kind of too small ball when you're talking about these things. And so I think sometimes that's off-putting. And that leads to why, you know, people sometimes say, like, I just don't understand this stuff. Like, it's actually not that hard to understand. It's what's hard to do is to predict what will happen. And that's perfectly fine to just say that's hard to do. But I think it makes the pitch harder.
Nick, you're an enthusiast, right?
Yeah. I think, absolutely. And I own Bitcoin and Ethereum. And it took me a while to do that, Matt, as I told you and your fifth column comrades in a special episode in Miami this summer, where I was to cover the big Bitcoin conference. I didn't want to buy Bitcoin when I first heard about it in 2008, when the paper came out in, on Halloween of 2008. And then when it actually launched in 2009, because I was, yeah. I didn't want to get too close to the story that I was going to be covering. In classic John Travolta in perfect fashion, really fucking boneheaded, bizarre ethics choice on my part, not known for ethics, except when it really hurts me. We have been covering Bitcoin at least since 2011. There's an early video, an interview I did with Jerry Brito, who was then at Mercatus, is now a big Bitcoin kind of activist and architect and thinker. We've got a ton of stuff. We have a video coming out today or tomorrow about how the environmentalist cases against Bitcoin are bullshit, they're wrong, and they are a cover for political, economic, and cultural elites that don't want to have to grapple with the actual challenge that Bitcoin poses to central banks and fiat currency. Having said all of that, and you know, there's a ton of stuff that we did and we're doing. Google, you know, go to Bitcoin at thereason.com archive. I agree with Catherine, though, that ultimately what Bitcoin is going to do is, I don't think it's not going to become the world's reserve currency. It's not going to become the thing that we pay for everything in or forms of crypto, but it's already expanding and increasing what is possible. It's a massive boon to people living in authoritarian countries. We had a great video earlier this year from Alex Gladstein of the Human Rights Foundation talking about how Bitcoin allows people in places like China, Iraq, Iran, Venezuela to circumvent authoritarian governments. You know, we interviewed Cynthia Lummis, the senator from Wyoming, who started a crypto group in Congress to start educating idiot people in Congress about what Bitcoin is and why it's a good thing. It's definitely going to help make it harder for central banks not to try to do stupid things, but to actually be able to do that. And I think that's great. And there are going to be challenges to it, you know, by the end of the Biden administration. Whether that's, you know, in a couple of years or in 6 weeks or, you know, at the end of a second term, there will be Bitcoin controls in place and they'll kind of work, but they'll have also increased whatever is left over will have massively increased the possibility of people to kind of buy and trade and transact more on the terms that they want. Bitcoin is fantastic. And it's not about getting rich. It's about empowering people in decentralized ways. And the best stuff is coming yet. In terms of blockchain-based decentralized payment systems, as well as kind of messaging systems and information systems.
Suderman, I'd like to use you as transition bait here in that. First of all, you got to tell us how much Coinbase you own. But then secondly, a lot of people look at Bitcoin and other crypto as a hedge against inflation at a time when currencies are being debased. Inflation, we've just seen, has the biggest year-over-year total since 1990. It's up to 6.2%, the consumer price index. And that's also having an impact on the aforementioned sort of stalling of Biden's domestic agenda with Joe Manchin, senator of from coal country, Joe Manchin in particular, citing inflation concerns for reasons to block the Build Back Better, whatever bill, while Biden is saying that we need to pass it in order to defeat inflation. We're going to whip it now. So first, if you just confess your own crypto holdings, if you'd like, and then maybe either cogitate on the relationship between crypto and inflation, or just tell us a little bit about the role of inflation at the Build Back Better negotiation.
Yeah, so I don't own any Bitcoin or Bitcoin-like currency because I made a really big mistake in my life, which was I didn't listen to my gun nut Kentucky IT dudes. Like my close,
my close group of dudes,
all of whom have some sort of IT background, even if that's not exactly what they work in now, all of whom are some level of gun collector, gun fanatic, all of whom carry weapons large and small with them virtually everywhere, Nick. And so if you want to get comfortable with that sort of thing, have a close group of friends who carry weapons with them. And that is a good way to become more comfortable with that sort
of... The one time I was comfortable with people with machine guns, or not machine guns, but semi-automatic weapons on their backs was at Porkfest.
And it becomes much more comfortable when they are your close friends who you know and who you trust, and that's going to be...
Well, that's... You have different friends than I do.
Probably,
but I am happy that you have a positive friend group.
But trust is going to come into this, I think, a little bit later.
An armed society is a polite society.
As for sort of my kind of general approach to Bitcoin is similar to Catherine's. I think there are risks to Bitcoin as a specific application as it exists now. In particular, there are regulatory risks, and you saw this over the last 6 or 8 months where the Bitcoin boosters were saying, look, if we end up with the regulations that are being proposed as part of the infrastructure bill, then that's going to kneecap Bitcoin as a useful technology. And if it's that easy to do via regulation, then that means there are serious regulatory risks built into the technology, and that those are going to continue to be there just as long as we have, you know, a government. So I am not certain about how Bitcoin, as we currently conceive of it, is going to play out over the next several years. But I am extremely bullish on the underlying technology, on blockchain and on public crypto, because I think those are going to change. That's just going to change the world. So think about the big problem in human society. The big problem in human society, like the deepest one, is establishing trust, in particular, establishing trust between strangers. And so that's obviously a very specific problem when it comes to trading, right? And to payment processing. And so typically we solve that problem with third parties, with intermediaries, payment processors. So that's everything from Stripe to PayPal to Visa to even just sort of normal banks. And what blockchain does is it creates a system for establishing trust between strangers without a third party. There's no middleman that's needed because it's all just there publicly on the blockchain. Right. And so as we move forward into our digitally interconnected global internet economy, we are going to need to do a lot more business and a lot more transactions, many financial and just sort of strictly commercial, but also other types of transactions with strangers, because there are a lot of strangers in the world and all of them are going to be on the internet. And so blockchain is going to be the kind of the underlying technology that allows us to establish trust with strangers in a way that everybody can feel comfortable with. And I think that that is ultimately going to be crypto's biggest value. Even if we end up with a somewhat kneecapped Bitcoin as currency system, as may happen.
I want to push back on that, though, because we have developed in a global economy, and it took years to get it online, but we have really good third-party, you know, payment systems or people that will authorize these trades and also will take the risk. I use a Visa or MasterCard. I can reverse the charges and they'll always take them. In a way, with Bitcoin, with Bitcoin and most crypto, once you make a deal, that's it and it's over. I think the real value, so I'm not saying you're wrong, but that the real value of Bitcoin is what was done on Silk Road, which is where Bitcoin allows you to transact, which we covered a lot. Ross Ulbricht, who I think is a real martyr to, you know, a 20th century model of governance. But what was great about Bitcoin in that context, and that's what the payment systems were based on, it allowed you to do things that government said you were not allowed to do. If you could buy drugs using Visa and MasterCard and Discover and PayPal, people would do that, but you can't. And what Bitcoin does, Bitcoin is an outlaw technology that expands what is possible. And even with Ross Ulbricht in jail, by the time, you know, Silk Road was shut down, and within a couple of weeks, multiple Silk Roads popped up, and there were more, you know, underground Bitcoin unauthorized drug markets and other kind of systems to especially to buy and sell things you can't do openly. And I think that's the real utopian potential. And even when government shuts that down, there's always a little bit of residue left. And there's also that example in front of you to just start expanding what you are able to do because you want to do it, not because the government will allow it.
I agree with that. But I do think that the more mainstream that crypto becomes, the less of an outlaw technology it will become.
Let's go to our end of podcast, what you have been consuming. I hear that the nerds consumed the same damn thing. So, Catherine, do you want to talk about it?
We read the new Neal Stephenson novel, Termination Shock, and it's good, you guys. It is reviewed on Reason.com. If not quite yet, it probably will be by the time you listen to this podcast. And Peter will lead our discussion since he has finished it, and I have not quite finished it yet. But it is Neal Stephenson's global warming novel.
Yeah.
And it's good.
It's fantastic. So it's Neal Stephenson who helped people think through, among other things, the metaverse, which now Facebook is like reinventing or inventing for real in his novel Snow Crash, but also was a sort of crypto, an innovator in crypto theory.
He's and actually wrote, Satoshi Nakamoto.
We have not established that. And
we
that,
believe
is
it.
That is a joke allegation as far as we are concerned here.
I'll
just say, if it turned out that he was Satoshi Nakamoto and he has denied being Satoshi, would you be that surprised? I wouldn't be that surprised.
He's denied it.
It seems like the kind of thing.
We should be clear. He's denied it in response to Peter Suderman alleging it in our pages, just to be clear. But yeah, so this is the global warming novel. And do y'all remember, I guess now 3 summers ago, when the meme of the 30 to 50 feral hogs appeared? Do you remember that? So the 30 to 50 feral hogs are clearly, I don't know if they were the whole inspiration for this novel, but they are like the mascots of this novel. They are the patron spirits of this novel. So, you know, I just really feel like the sentence 30 to 50 feral hogs and Neal Stephenson's global warming novel should be enough for anyone. And if it's not, we're probably not going to sell you.
What I really love about Neal Stephenson is he is a science fiction author who believes that the job of science fiction is to propose solutions to problems. And his solutions are always people figure out how to solve the little problem that they have through engineering. And that's it, right? And it is a visionary engineer's view of how society self-organizes. And all of his books are about how distributed solutions by people working from their own, you know, from the things that they want out of life and working to solve the small problem that is in front of them rather than the big global problem that, needs everybody to come together politically and sign treaties and like have government organizations. His whole shtick is, what if we didn't do that? And instead, we just solved the little problem that we have right now. And then after that, we solved the next little problem. And sometimes those little problems are actually very big problems. And so this is a book about solving global. I shouldn't say solving. It is about responding to global warming via geoengineering. And so the book kicks off when a Texas billionaire decides to start shooting sulfur into the atmosphere. And now this is something that geoengineering folks have talked about for decades now. In fact, it was done naturally when Mount Pinatubo exploded in the early 1990s. That actually led to a couple of years of cooler global temperatures. But you could do it relatively cheaply, to the point where even somebody who, and this guy is funny, he describes himself as like a small billionaire, not one of those big guys, right? But even where like a small billionaire who just owns a bunch of land in Texas and is tired of it being hot in Texas, also it's costing him money, decides, you know what? I am going to cool things down here by taking action, right? By taking matters in my own hands and taking action. And then, of course, that does create complications. Well, you shoot sulfur into the air and it does cool things, but it doesn't affect everywhere equally. So then there are political complications that come into play. And other people start taking matters into their own hands in different ways. So there are other private groups that start shooting sulfur into the air. There are governments that that get mad about the sulfur additions, right? And try to take action on their own. But at each point, it's not like a theory of global warming or of human affairs that says what we really need is massive political solutions, global governance, right, where we come together and set rules that tell everybody what to do. Instead, it's a theory of the world that says, look, this is a problem. In its own way, it's too big a problem for anybody to kind of wrap their head around. But you can wrap your head around the small problem of, it's too hot on my ranch properties in Texas, or rising sea level is going to affect the Dutch specifically, so they need to build stuff to stop it, right? And you can engineer your way out of those specific, discrete, concrete problems without having to turn it into a massive everything problem that requires all the countries in the world to get together and have climate meetings that don't result in anything actually happening.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
Before I turn to that, Matt Welch, I would just point out that in 1997, Reason ran a cover story by the astrophysicist and science fiction novelist Gregory Benford called Climate Controls, which was an overview of what was then capable or hypothetically capable via geoengineering. And a lot of it, I've read a couple of interviews with Stevenson. A lot of it looks like it's very similar. So it'd be interesting to go back and look at shortly, a couple of years after Snow Crash came out, the novel that Stevenson coined the term metaverse in came out, what Reason was thinking about geoengineering. What I consumed this past week was multiple. I went to the premiere of Listening to Kenny G, a fantastic documentary about smooth jazz and its critics. And I also went to see Flying Over Sunset, and I'm being buzzed now. But I went to see Flying Over Sunset, a Broadway musical about Cary Grant, Claire Booth Luce, and Aldous Huxley taking acid together in Southern California. But what I'm going to talk about
Could
this
you
week
sing us one of
is,
the numbers?
You really, beyond the fact that my voice is terrible, the music is actually pretty terrible. So it would just be, I think it would cause a carbon sink. But instead, what I'm going to talk about this time is a group called Heroes for Liberty, of all things, has come out with a series of action figures and kids' biographies of people, including Thomas Sowell, the rogue maverick economist, who kind of like Neal Stephenson, but in the academy, has come up with radical ways in which, or he demonstrates how individuals working through things without elite consensus or guidance or authorization go about making their world a better place. Thomas Sowell is one of the heroes of liberty. The book is called A Self-Made Man, and you can buy it with a bizarre little action figure of an economist with really chunky kind of late 70s, early 80s aviator style eyeglasses. So that's what I was consuming, Matt.
Very good. What I consumed was the documentary that came out this summer by Questlove, the drummer from The Roots and the band leader for the Jimmy Fallon show. The documentary is called Summer of Soul, and it is it's great. It's terrific. If you love music, you go watch it. It's managed to get this big pile of footage from a festival that basically no one had heard of except the attendees and the performers for many, many years, even though it was filmed really, really well and recorded well. The sound of it, I mean, they might have done a lot of surgery in the post-op once they found these tapes and got the rights to them. And I think there's a backstory behind that that hasn't fully been told. But the sound quality is remarkable. So it was a series of summer concerts in New York in the summer of 1969, which is the same summer that the more ballyhooed Woodstock Festival took place up in upstate New York. But here in Harlem, in a park that holds, I don't know, 10, 15, 20, 30,000 people, very, very black crowds, very, very black acts. And yet no one had really heard about them. And they're just top flight, like Nina Simone at the top of her game, Stevie Wonder, right as he's about to morph from, you know, suit wearing Motown guy to the explorer of the inner visions and outer visions alike. There's Jesse Jackson shows up, and there's all the documentary. It shows all this great footage, but it also attempts to contextualize it within the politics and racial politics and others in 1969. Which makes it pretty interesting. Although, if you're a big, big music nerd, what you basically want them to do is to have another one that's seven times as long that just has all the footage because it's so incredibly good. Sly and the Family Stone comes down from Planet Xenu to perform.
Well, and from Woodstock. He's one of the Sly and the Family Stone are like, that's who I want to see a, you know, Dan Carlin hardcore history 40 hours.
Holy
episode
cow.
About. You know, they're like a really interesting band.
There's a great piece because they also interview fans, including like people who are sort of like teenagers and on the prowl and little kids, and they're recalling their memories. And these this one guy is like, yeah, you know, me and my bros were all we were like we'd all wear the matching suits. You know, it was very sort of Motown, Temptations, Platters, whatever. And then as soon as you saw Sly and the Family Stone come out with their like funky white drummer and crazy gal playing the trumpet and just they're incredible. They're like, well, that's the last time we're wearing the suit. We're going in a different direction. But anyways, it's a very, very good documentary if you like music and the drum sound especially. I think that Questlove put his fingerprints on that in the mixes. It's remarkable. And Catherine, to lure you in, there's also an interesting little selection about kind of reflecting on the moon landing, which happened in the middle of all of this, because it was a series of weekends in the summer of 69. And contemporaneous interviews with people in the crowd at this festival talking about how, you know, they should have spent money on something else. It's pretty funny. Anyways, it's very good. Summer of Soul. You can get a Hulu. I'm sure it's easy to find elsewhere.
Understand how deep a music nerd Questlove is, he's like my personal hero when it comes to record collecting, because he has a record collection that is one of the biggest in the world. He owns 200,000 vinyl LPs and in fact had to buy a farm in upstate New York just to help house all of his vinyl collection. And he has said that it is aspirational that he hopes to one day listen to 5% of his records.
I will throw out a final shout out to an act who I hadn't really thought a lot about. Didn't really kind of picture them as black, to be honest, is the Fifth Dimension and their performance, and also them reflecting Billy D or Billy Davis, I forget his name, and Marilyn McCoo reflecting afterwards and like, you know, getting a little bit choked up and thinking what it meant to play in front of a majority black audience at a time when they were considered to be a white group. And it's a great performance. And the style and the outfits are just fantastic. Recommend it highly. Anyways, that's enough of me talking and us talking. And you'll hear us talk again next Monday when we'll know a lot more than we know now, because the pursuit of knowledge is eternal.
Well, we only know that we know less than we think we know.
Yeah, I mean, I might gain a full week's worth of knowledge, but I also might forget a full week's worth of knowledge at the same time.
Or I will be smarter next week. Thank you.
That was a really bad way to end the episode, Matt.
You know what? I won't come on the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie at the end of yours and interject editorial comments.
I hear it in my ears, Matt. Yeah, I hear it in my head.
Listen to all our podcasts, even the bad one on Wednesday, reason.com podcast, and we'll see you next week. Goodbye.